The Exxon Valdez is still sitting off the coast of San Diego, and it's still leaking oil. The tanker was to have been towed into the port of San Diego for repairs. On Friday, the California Attorney General went to court to get an injunction temporarily barring the tanker from entering state waters. They want the tanker to stay at least 3 miles offshore until there is no danger of pollution.
It was early spring in Alaska when the Exxon Valdez spilled 11 million barrels of crude oil into the Prince William Sound. Now, more than 3 months later, cleanup activity is still in high gear. Thousands of people are at work on the water, the beaches, and in the air. They're trying to clean up the mess created by the nation's worst oil spill. Steve Will toured the cleanup activity at Northwest Bay, a part of Prince William Sound that was hit with a lot of oil.
There's oil right here. And there's also oil over there.
Northwest Bay, Eleanor Island, Prince William Sound. When oil spewed from the Exxon Valdez, Northwest Bay was directly in the path of the ensuing spill. It lay like a gaping mouth, collecting North Slope crude as it flowed towards the Pacific. 3 months later, people strain their imaginations to come up with analogies for the scene at Northwest Bay, something out of Dante, or an Hieronymus Bosch painting, the landing scene in Apocalypse Now. It's difficult to envision the solitude, impossible to hear the silence that reigned here just a few months ago. This is heavy industry, a large-scale salvage operation in full swing.
We counted the boats last night, the boats that were larger than skiff size, if you count those as skiffs. And there was 111 just in this bay.
A great barge floats at anchor, piled high with plastic bags of oily waste. Fishing boats drag oil collecting skimmers through the water, having abandoned summer fisheries for the big bucks Exxon pays to work the spill. Hundreds of people are at work in Northwest Bay, employees of Exxon, their contractors Vico and Norcan. Scientists study underwater sediments, intertidal marine life, water quality, all assessing damage and possible liability. State officials, federal officials, the military, dozens of organizations are involved in the work. They don't talk about cleaning the beaches anymore, treating or washing, yes, but there's no illusion that these beaches will be clean by summer's end. That's not for lack of effort. Exxon is pouring thousands of people and millions of dollars into the project, but the task is simply too great. This is Maxi 12, one of the large weapons in the shoreline cleanup battle. The unit consists of a barge and a tug. The tug constantly pushes at the barge, keeping it snug against the shoreline. On board the barge, 20 people work compressors, boilers, and fire hoses, but the heart of the operation is a 50-foot boom that reaches from the barge high over the beach. A woman is perched in a basket at the end of the boom, aiming a nozzle at the oiled rocks below. High-pressure warm water from the nozzle breaks the tar-like goo loose from rocks. High-volume water from the barge-mounted fire hoses washes the oil into the sea.
We just moved to this area today because there's just a section in here that was not, well, it keeps getting recovered with oil. And we're trying to get it cleaned up for the last time and be done with it.
The maxi barges are used for steep, rocky shoreline treatment where the coast slopes gently into the sea. People go on shore, the beach crews, infantry. They're not here to rescue oiled birds and animals or to collect dead ones. Most have either died or left by now. Otters are rarely sighted, and the absence of birds is haunting. Treatment sites are better measured in meters than miles, with days required to wash any one site. On a good day, a crew can wash 5 to 10 barrels of oil from a beach. Exxon claims they've recovered over 55,000 barrels of oil so far. 11 million barrels leaked from the Exxon Valdez, and even the best efforts of a beach crew can be destroyed by one high tide. This beach has been washed 5 times, yet the rocks remain dark and slick with decomposing North Slope crude.
It got pretty heavily oiled, and we're just repeatedly washing it off the surface as it comes up. Mostly it's porosity, just the size of the rocks that are here. It's small stuff, there's a lot of interstitial spaces, and the ground just soaks it right up.
Getting oil off the beaches is just part of the problem. Keeping it from escaping back into Prince William Sound is another. Each treatment site is supposed to be corralled off by booms, floating obstacles intended to trap the oil near the shore. There are usually primary booms immediately surrounding the worksite and secondary booms further out. Boom tenders, like the beach crews, live in the oil. Their slickers and boats are filthy with it.
These boom haulers have one of the hardest jobs because physically, they're exerting themselves a lot, and they're sweating up underneath, and then they're sitting out there in the cold, and end up getting chilled because most of the time it's raining out here, and they're probably more prone to getting sick than the rest of the crews.
Floating skimmers collect some of the oil, both inside and outside of the booms. Some is sopped up with absorbent pads and pom-poms, the latter looking exactly like their namesake. But the oil has a way of leaking out. Booms break. They're frequently open to allow vessel access to and from the worksite, and some of it just seems to slip past.
Okay, well, we're going in here and their boom is broken. You know that? There's a lot of oil coming out of here, he said, from the helicopter. Okay. We need to address the situation, see if we can find the Exxon person who can find a skimmer to take care of this area while this.
Some 900 miles of Alaskan shoreline were soiled by the Exxon Valdez spill. About a tenth of that has been treated to the Coast Guard's satisfaction, but even the untrained eye can see that those beaches are a long ways from being oil-free. Exxon says the treatment is ahead of schedule. They also say crews will be back next spring. In the end, there is a limit to what people can do about the damage.
It's going to get as clean as humans can possibly get it. And then there comes a time when Mother Nature has to do the rest.
For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Will at Northwest Bay. It's a little.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Noah Adams. Poor management by Exxon Shipping led to the Valdez oil spill disaster. That's the less than surprising conclusion contained in a report released yesterday by the state of Alaska. The 110-page document is Alaska's conclusion from 5 days of National Transportation Safety Board hearings held in May. The state is now hoping that the NTSB agrees with their findings when it issues its own report. Bruce Melzer from member station KSKA in Anchorage reports.
With this latest report, the state chronicles the wreck of the Exxon Valdez, and Exxon Shipping Company's failure to supervise its own operations. State Oil Spill Coordinator Bob Loresh, who prepared the document, says Exxon Shipping failed to help the ship's captain, Joseph Hazelwood, after learning he was an alcoholic. Loresh says the company failed to track the captain's recovery and overworked and understaffed its tanker crews. When you add it all up, he says, the causes of the nation's worst oil spill are quite pedestrian.
This wasn't any natural catastrophe or crazy man at the helm. There was a bunch of guys in their offices in Houston and Valdez who were too busy giving speeches to pay attention to giving their people who were in charge of their operations the proper training, the proper motivation, and the proper crews to do things safely.
Loresh reserves special criticism for Exxon Shipping Company President Frank Iarossi, saying he was more concerned with lobbying to reduce the size of tanker crews than he was with running his company. Exxon has not responded yet to the state report. The other party to blame, says Loresh, is the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operator of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and the Valdez Oil Port. Repeating the state's long-held position, Loresh says Alyeska was totally unprepared for a big spill and failed to respond when it occurred. He says that's due in part to the fact that Alyeska is owned by a consortium of seven major oil companies.
And the owner companies quite probably refused to fund the proper response team, proper response equipment. Basically, they were hiding behind the skirts of Alyeska, and when the time came, there were no skirts there.
Alyeska says it doesn't want to get pulled into the fray and won't respond directly to the state's criticism. But spokesman Tom Brennan says his company's own filings before the safety board repeat its long-standing position on the spill. Alyeska, he says, mobilized and did everything humanly possible to contain the tide of crew that flowed from the crippled tanker on March 24th. The state's Bob Loresh says government can't legislate competence, but it can enforce regulations to prevent incidents like the Exxon oil spill. 13 recommendations are included in the state report for NTSB consideration. They include random drug testing of tanker crews, giving the Coast Guard access to driving records, and upgrading navigational aids in Prince William Sound. The NTSB is still preparing its findings on the Exxon Valdez grounding. The final report isn't expected for at least 6 months. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Melzer in Anchorage, Alaska.
Interior Secretary Manuel Lujan today defended offshore drilling as vital to the national interest. He told a meeting of Western governors, the time is running out. We need, he said, a firm, predictable offshore leasing program to meet our needs. From Long Beach, California, Wendy Kaufman reports.
Interior Secretary Manuel Lujan's address represents a major effort by the Bush administration to blunt a wave of anti-drilling sentiment in the Congress and the country. Today, Lujan recited what he called the stark facts. We import more than half of all the oil we use and are more dependent on Mideast drillers than ever before.
This is a time bomb waiting to explode, and unless we act quickly to defuse it, all of us could be injured. My good friends, I believe that the answer to this current energy crisis lies just several miles off our shores and in Alaska.
Lujan said the choice was not between oil and the environment. Rather, he said, it is a choice between utilizing our vast domestic energy resources in an environmentally sound manner or holding our nation's energy hostage to a volatile and unpredictable world. Lujan today took strong exception to a comprehensive oil drilling moratorium passed last week by the House of Representatives and now being seriously considered by the Senate. In addition to a one-year ban on actual drilling, the moratorium prohibits pre-lease activities like feasibility and environmental studies. Today, Lujan said that was totally out of line.
Blindly reject even the possibility before us, burying our heads in the sands of our own ignorance.
Later, pressed by reporters, Lujan indicated he would not be opposed to a moratorium on drilling, but that prohibiting all pre-lease activities was totally unwarranted. Lujan did offer the governor's one suggestion to reduce environmental dangers of offshore drilling. He said the Department of Interior is now considering the increased use of deepwater ports, such as the one now in place in Louisiana. The worst environmental dangers stem from oil tankers, he said, and by decreasing the amount of oil transported by ship, the nation could reduce its environmental exposure. For the most part, the governor's reaction to Lujan was polite. Governor Steve Cooper of Alaska and California's George Dukmejian agree with Lujan that a flat moratorium on oil drilling activities is unwarranted. But Cooper did express reservations about the use of deep water ports in Alaska, and he noted that such ports are extremely expensive. Only Oregon's Neil Goldschmidt publicly challenged the Department of Interior's commitment to meeting the state's environmental concerns.
As of this day, we are in a confrontation which has produced statutes in both states to put a moratorium inside the three-mile limit, and has produced flat-out opposition by the citizens who are convinced because there is no negotiation, there's no intent to incorporate any environmental sensitivity at all.
The Western governors also heard from Energy Secretary James Watkins. He stressed the new spirit at his department and, as he has in the past, pledged his commitment to safety. In Long Beach, California, this is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
This is Morning Edition. I'm Alex Chadwick, sitting in for Bob Edwards. Exxon says it will stop efforts to clean up the Alaska oil spill at the end of the summer and does not intend to resume in the spring. The company says its decision is final, no matter what the state and federal governments want it to do. Sue Rapley reports from member station KCHU in Valdez.
Exxon says its position since early May has been to complete cleanup operations and demobilize by mid-September, removing all personnel and equipment from the area. September 15th is cited as the approximate date when winter storms set in, and Exxon says it would be unsafe to continue operations beyond then. Spokesman Blue Beathard says Exxon feels it has committed all the resources possible in people and boats at a cost of $880 million in the first half of this year. He says Exxon will have completed all the work that can be effectively done by the time it has to demobilize for winter. But the State Department of Environmental Conservation doesn't agree that Exxon will be finished treating all the heavily oiled beaches by the 15th of September. And the state thinks work should continue as long as possible with seaworthy craft and trained crews. The state's on-site coordinator, Steve Provant, also disagrees with Exxon that there will be little need for work in the spring.
They hope that the oil is going to disappear, and I don't think it will. If it does disappear off some of the beaches here, it's going to very likely reappear down around Seward or Homer or Kodiak. So I think we're going to see significant problems that have to be dealt with next summer.
But Exxon spokesman Beathard contends that whatever re-oiling that occurs in the winter will be dissipated by 6 months of tidal action.
If there is some oil, we expect that it will be weathered. It'll be sort of like asphalt. There may be some streaks on rocks. And we do not think that it will pose any environmental threat.
Exxon predicts that wide-scale use of a new chemical, plus application of fertilizer to enhance the natural breakdown process, will greatly increase the speed and effectiveness of the shoreline treatment by fall. But the State Department of Environmental Conservation wants toxicity tests completed before allowing Exxon to try those types of treatment. For National Public Radio, I'm Sue Rapley in Valdez, Alaska.
It's 4 months since the Exxon Valdez spilled 11 million gallons of crude into Prince William Sound, but oil from the spill is still disrupting fishing in Alaska. Last week, state officials announced that hundreds of fishermen in Cook Inlet, about 300 miles from Prince William Sound, will miss the entire sockeye salmon season. Eileen Hughes of member station KBBI in Homer, Alaska, reports on how the 600-boat drift net fleet will be affected.
The fishery was closed because of tar balls, gooey blobs of brownish oil mixed with seaweed and other debris. The tar balls are remnants from the Exxon Valdez spill that followed the currents into Cook Inlet and are floating on tide rips right in the middle of the prime fishing grounds. State officials are afraid that the tar balls will foul nets and contaminate fish. And under a stringent policy implemented since the Exxon spill, no fishing can occur in areas where there's any oil. The drift net season in Cook Inlet was supposed to open in late June, but it kept getting delayed because of the tar balls. Now, the peak of the sockeye salmon run is over and the oil is still there. It's the first time in the 40-year history of the fishery that the fleet will miss out on the season. The Kenai River is where many of the boats anchor. The river is dotted with hundreds of boats that have been sitting idle for weeks. There's an eerie feeling. Fisherman Jim Wells has been hanging around the river with nothing to do.
It's a sad day for us. It's the first year in 20 years that I haven't fished here. We're here, we got the boats ready to go, the nets are ready to go, the crewmen are here, everything's, you know, you're right on the edge. So it's really hard. We're fishermen, that's our job. It'd be like an accountant without an office or a logger without any trees to work on. It's the same thing. That's what you miss. A very sad thing. If you look behind you, there's a new boat right here that was just built this year. Probably $220,000 investment. Hasn't laid a net out yet.
There's a seasonal rhythm to a fisherman's life, but this summer everything is out of whack. Jerry Wills has been fishing Cook Inlet for 30 years. Normally right now, Wills would be catching hundreds of salmon and making thousands of dollars. He says it's hard to describe how bad he feels about missing a salmon season.
It's terrible. You visit with some of your old-time friends and you don't even want to talk about this thing, and yet you have to. And the feelings are not good. The feelings are 180 degrees from what you'd normally be sharing at this time of year. You'd normally be maybe strutting into the river at the end of a long, hard day, exhausted. But exhaustion came from super hard work, and it's just a great, great feeling. And instead of those feelings, we're feeling just totally different. It made me so sick the other day when I heard they were closing this down that I wanted to cry. Now, a grown man Alaskan fisherman doesn't cry, right?
Exxon has promised to compensate fishermen for the loss of their season. Each fisherman has been advanced $10,000, and further payments are pending. Now fishermen will be spending a lot of time talking to attorneys and dealing with paperwork for their claims. And already, they're starting to fret about what's in store for next summer. There's still oil on the beaches along the outer coast on the Gulf of Alaska and in Prince William Sound. And there are fears that the oil will keep shedding off the beaches all winter, bringing tar balls into Cook Inlet again next summer. Fisherman Steve Koskela.
There's next year to look forward to, you know, as long as Exxon gets the oil cleaned up so we don't have a bunch of tar balls bobbing up the inlet next year. And that's what we've got to make sure happens. Don't want to just have a show of people out there and money being spent. We want the oil cleaned up.
For National Public Radio, I'm Eileen Hughes in Homer, Alaska.
This weekend, the Exxon Valdez may finally make it to port in San Diego, more than 4 months after it left the nation's worst oil spill in Prince William Sound, Alaska. During the last 3 weeks, the ship has been barred from San Diego Harbor because it apparently was leaking oil residue. Officials say it may be safe to let the Valdez in as early as Saturday. Until then, it remains about 50 miles offshore. Here's more from Lynn Weil of CalNet Public Radio.
Inspectors in Alaska said the Valdez was clean when it left Prince William Sound, but steel plates used to patch the damaged hull were shoved out of place in transit. And the theory is that when the ship reached the warmer waters of Southern California, oily residue was washed out. The state of California says the substance is oil, but U.S. Coast Guard officials aren't sure. They haven't been able to determine its content from laboratory tests. The Coast Guard won't let the boat in the bay until the substance disappears. Coast Guard Lieutenant Larry Salberg says when divers repairing the ship removed one of the steel plates on Monday, a little more seeped out.
We had a slight release as they cut off one of the plates, very light. It was not feasible to even clean up. They tried, but dissipated before they could get the equipment on scene.
The Valdez can't dock in San Diego until the 7 steel plates are removed from its hull. They hang down too far and the harbor is too shallow. The plate removal process is expected to be completed today. Even then, California state officials have imposed further conditions, to which Exxon agreed yesterday. Exxon spokeswoman Jan Kuhl says it's a longer and more stringent list than 3 weeks ago.
Some of the factors include a $10 million performance bond to pay any judgments or fines, a $1 million fund to pay any upfront costs incurred should a release occur. We have to test response boats and equipment. We have to have a response boat to accompany the Valdez into the harbor, and they go on.
Jan Kuhl says Exxon was eager to comply.
What we had when the original slick was observed, I think, is a crisis of confidence, and we've agreed to these things to assure the state that we will bring the ship in an environmentally responsible manner.
The Exxon Valdez is supposed to dock at the shipyard where it was built. There, it'll undergo 9 months of repair at an estimated cost of $45 million. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Weil.
The Alaska Attorney General's Office has decided not to press charges against the Exxon Corporation for the Exxon Valdez oil spill last March. The chief of criminal prosecution said that in relation to the resources that would have to be expended, the possible penalties would just not be sufficient. Peter Kenyon of Alaska Public Radio reports.
After months of investigation, Alaska's chief prosecutor Larry Weeks has concluded that any criminal charges against Exxon or the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company will have to come from the Justice Department. The best the state could hope for are penalties of up to $100,000 and 90 days in jail, while under federal law, Exxon could be liable for 3 times the actual damages caused by the spill. Federal officials confirm that an investigation is underway, but have no further comment. This announcement will have no effect on the state felony charges still pending against former Exxon Valdez captain Joseph Hazelwood. But it will leave more money for the state to build a civil case against Exxon, which is expected later this year. For National Public Radio, I'm Peter Kenyon in Juneau, Alaska.
The president of Exxon USA tried to persuade a skeptical congressional committee today that the company is not going to abandon efforts to clean up its huge Alaskan oil spill. This despite an internal company memo leaked earlier this week that suggested otherwise. The testimony came amid federal reports that Exxon has treated only about a third of the more than 700 miles of coastline affected by the spill, and that some of the beaches that were scrubbed once are now getting dirty again, as oil buried in the sediments oozes to the surface. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling reports that the legislators did not find the Exxon president's assurances entirely reassuring.
The controversial memo was written by Exxon's top official in charge of the oil spill cleanup, a man named Otto Harrison. In his brief and clearly written memo, Harrison said that Exxon is pulling out its cleanup equipment and crews starting September 15th, that the company will not do any more cleaning up during the winter because the weather won't be safe. And then Harrison went on to say, emphatically, that Exxon's only commitment next year, and I'm quoting from the memo here, our only commitment for the spring of 1990 is to survey the shoreline. No commitment, the memo went on to say, should be made to any private or government party for 1990 activity. These are not negotiable points, unquote. But today, Exxon President W.D. Stevens testified under oath that that's not really what Harrison meant to say.
Now, admittedly, in retrospect, the wording in Mr. Harrison's memo was unfortunate. But I think we need to realize the conditions under which that man is working up there. It's a very big job. He's got a very large organization. He doesn't take a lot of time to carefully word memos. But,
Stevens said, Exxon stands by the pledge which the chairman of the board made to stockholders in May, and he quoted,
"We will return to the area in the spring of 1990 to reinspect the area to assure that the job has been properly done, and, if not, to put it right."
But legislators wanted to know exactly what Exxon executives mean by those words, "put it right." Just suppose, legislators asked Stevens, suppose Exxon comes back next spring and surveys the shorelines and decides we have put it right and there's nothing more to clean up. We're going home. And suppose the Coast Guard disagrees and tells Exxon there's far more cleaning up to do. As Committee Chairman George Miller asked, will Exxon do more cleanup if the Coast Guard recommends it? The questions and answers here have been edited to save time.
Mr. Stevens, is Exxon going to follow the directions of the Coast Guard and its role as the on-sea federal management next spring?
Well, I would have to say yes, in terms of any reasonable request, any reasonable job that needs to be done. Yes, we will.
But that word reasonable did not satisfy legislators either. And for the next 2 hours, one legislator after another tried to pin Stevens down. Will Exxon keep cleaning up next year if the Coast Guard recommends it? George Miller again.
The question for me is Mr. Stevens, is whether or not when that decision is made, you're going to comply with it.
I think the only basis I have to speculate about the future is the experience of the past. And the sort of question you're posing is hypothetical. I mean, I have, you know, you and I have had no discussion about what the conditions or the situation might be and what the decision that the Coast Guard reaches might be.
And they pushed Stevens again.
The only issue is whether or not Exxon is going to comply with that or not comply with that.
My expectation, based on our prior experiences, that there will be no vast differences of view. Mr. Chairman,
well, that's an interesting answer. I mean, it's an interesting answer because I think, you know, you've chosen the words now five or six times. That's your answer, and that's fine. But maybe it does leave a little bit more wiggle room than I had heard the first time. Your past actions and your future actions can speak for themselves.
Well, again, I think your expectation of what we might do in the future would best also be based on what we have done in terms of acceptance of responsibility and meeting our obligations in the past.
Stevens suggested that the fact that Exxon has spent at least $675 million so far on the oil spill cleanup shows company executives have taken responsibility for the damage. Speaking of all those millions, incidentally, Stevens told the Congressional Committee that Exxon will deduct the cleanup costs from its taxes as an ordinary business expense. When one legislator said that means the nation's taxpayers will ultimately have to foot the bill, Stevens disagreed. He said that since Exxon is paying so much money to fishermen and boat owners and other people to clean up the oil, and since they will have to pay taxes, Exxon is creating wealth, in his words. I'm Daniel Zwerdling in Washington.
Tugboats pushed the ruptured oil tanker, the Exxon Valdez, into the San Diego harbor today on its way to dry dock and repairs. The Valdez hit a reef in Prince William Sound, Alaska last March, resulting in the nation's worst oil spill. The accident has fundamentally changed the lives of residents of Prince William Sound. David Grimes and Rick Steiner make their living fishing the Sound. They spent much of the summer helping in the cleanup effort there. Now they're touring the country, trying to get local communities involved in protecting their environment.
We recognize that during the cleanup, it was local people who were able to best defend the area. The so-called experts that came in, while they were often well-meaning, it's like if you had a fire in your own home and someone else comes in and asks you where the lights are, and then they say, where's the stairs? And then they say, what's important? Where's your silverware and where's your jewelry? That's what was missing in the whole plan. And on about the third or fourth day, Rick and I and several other people who by chance were in Valdez were able to join the planning committee and try to save at least a small part of the war.
Well, Rick, now you and David are touring local communities. Is your message that this is much more of a local issue than we think? That it's the responsibility of each community where oil is being shipped?
Absolutely. It's certainly a local responsibility, it's a regional responsibility, and it's also a global responsibility. We're all consuming oil. And for us to sit back and point the finger at Exxon and say it's their fault is about as ridiculous as it comes, because all of us let this happen.
What is the next step, and what is the hope for Prince William Sound to someday return to its natural state? In some ways, I'm not worried about Prince William Sound in the long term. It's a pristine body of water. If we don't spill oil in there anymore, it will clean itself up. What I am concerned about, and even what's killing the world's environment is not these catastrophic things. It's the day-to-day environmental degradation that we've all allowed, that little incremental degradation that we've all allowed to creep into our lives. I think the message, and the reason I'm optimistic maybe from Prince William Sound, heaven knows I didn't want it to happen, it's my home, but the message there is that I think it's waking people up to the fact that yes, the world is getting worse, and we do have to make a stand. And I think we're going to be coming to a time, and if you'd like to think that the 70s and 80s and were a lot about materialism, I think we're going to be coming to a time in this country where people realize that no matter how much profit your stock in Exxon is making, if your air and your water are bad, you really can't call that profit.
And you think that's going to come from some grassroots movement?
It's definitely coming from grassroots movements right now. And in our travels, we've left Prince William Sound for a little bit. We've got to get back up there soon and keep working. But we had a little time, and we felt that it was very important to check in with other coastal states, because we know that the work that they're doing is going to be tied in with the work that we're doing in Alaska, legislatively, spiritually, so to speak. When we visited communities in Chesapeake Bay and North Carolina, Virginia coast, we find a lot of people sharing those same problems. They all love their water. Whether it's the watermen that commercially fish, or people that sport fish, or just like to see the sunset on the water, people accept that as a fact of life. We take it for granted, and I think people are beginning to realize that what happened to Prince William Sound, where you wake up one day and that foundation of life is suddenly stripped from you, and you're incredibly shaken and distraught. I think people are seeing that that's what they're facing, and that they have to stand up and fight.
Alaska fisherman and environmental activist David Grimes and Rick Steiner.
Salmon fishing has been halted in Prince William Sound. Two major harvest zones in the region have been tainted by a sheen of oil on the water from the Exxon Valdez oil spill. More than 300 fishing boats have been idled. More than 200,000 pounds of fish could be contaminated. Fishermen are worried about what the contamination will do to the salmon market, even if the sound is reopened for fishing, and they're worried that the price of salmon will fall even further than it has already. Tom Fleming fishes in Prince William Sound.
The real heavy sheen that moves, oil sheen that moves over the top of the water, you know, it's just pretty obvious, and it stinks.
Does it look like fuel escaping from boats or something?
No, it's got the same, if you don't look at it close at all, it kind of has that same look, but you start looking at close, and a diesel sheen is, it just spreads out and it eventually evaporates, and a crude oil sheen don't much evaporate. It does slowly, but not near as fast as your diesel, and it's got a wrinkly effect to it, kind of like cellophane on the water, and it kind of breaks apart, which diesel sheen don't do.
And then, have you been fishing right through that?
I was fishing one time, yes, and picked my net up right in the middle of it.
What does that do? Presumably that gets the stuff all over your nets and whatever's in your net.
Well, it didn't appear to really, the water was cool enough and whatever, it didn't appear to stick to the net that much. But it did get enough of it on, when I put the fish aboard and stuff, I did have some of the sheen and stuff in my fish hole, and I did clean my fish hole and nets really well.
Well, now, why is fishing shut down now in Prince William Sound?
They claim it suspends itself down there. Now, I couldn't swear to for a fact. You know, after so much of the crude evaporates, it changes the consistency of it. It'll sink down a few feet under the water until it cools off, and then it kind of stays in that depth. and then when it warms up, they claim it brings it back to the surface again. Now, that could be what happened. I don't know for sure.
Mr. Fleming, when you catch fish that you think may be contaminated, if your contaminated fish were seized at the inspection station and thrown away, would Exxon compensate you for that because the oil spill caused the problem?
They're supposed to. I don't have a whole lot of faith in Exxon. I don't feel like we should have to take the risk of going out there and delivering contaminated fish to our markets with a chance of them getting to the market, you know, and I don't feel that we should have to take that chance.
Why not?
Well, if you get some oiled fish on the market, it's going to destroy your markets.
What about the salmon market? The market for Alaskan salmon must be affected by what has happened.
Oh, yeah. Well, last year we got anywhere from 70 cents to a dollar a pound for our pink salmon. This year we're getting 35.
Can you stay in business at those prices?
Well, probably could if you could fish, but the problem is you can't fish.
So either you get a very low price or you get run off the Sound entirely.
Well, that's what's happened so far, as we've tried to fish in it, and it smells like they might be trying to make us go again. Nobody wants to go, but you're in a catch-22 situation. You either go fishing and catch fish and get oiled and take a chance of putting them on your market and destroying that, or you don't go fishing and Exxon ain't going to pay you nothing.
Fisherman Tom Fleming spoke to us from his home in Cordova, Alaska.
There was a report this week about the eagles in Prince William Sound, Alaska. The Exxon oil spill late in March killed or displaced hundreds of bald eagles. 360 eagle nests were right in the impact area, the Fish and Wildlife Service says. Only 46 were active at the end of June. The eagles had been seen eating contaminated fish. Many unborn chicks died in the shell. The eagles were laying eggs just after the oil spill. There's also great concern about the other end of the food chain in Prince William Sound. The sound is home to many groups of killer whales, and every year humpback whales travel from Hawaii to feed in Alaskan waters.
A sighting is reported. 14:55 hours, the afternoon of July 30th, killer whales are seen. Two of them, moving north in Perry Passage, Prince William Sound, Alaska.
So far what I've seen is two big, large male killer whales, and skiff that's working these animals, it looks like they purposely have gone up after the large male to photo identify it. The large male's heading right toward our vessel now. I'd say less than a quarter of a mile away. And I'm going to slow up here a little bit as not to interfere with the primary vessel that's doing the photo ID work.
Marilyn Dahlheim, an oceanographer with the National Marine Mammal Laboratory. We're on the bridge of the boat Lucky Star. Out on the skiff, two whale researchers, their survival suits bright orange through the clouds low above the water of Prince William Sound. And we are watching the water, the waves, for the black dorsal fins of the whales.
Where'd they go?
Right here, Philip. Oh my goodness.
Okay, there's another male, and that animal's accompanied by either a subadult male or a female. And there's another animal farther off. There's three that surfaced right there. Four over here, five over here. Now we at least five, probably a lot more. There's at least two over there, so now we're up to six. Oh, there's three big males, unless that big male came home. No, nope, the male's still there, so we've got three big males.
How do you know they're males?
The tall erect dorsal fin. The female's dorsal fin is about 3 feet high and seems to be more sickle-shaped.
We decide to get closer. For the researchers, this is the moment of photo opportunity. We leave the Lucky Star, which is a fishing boat, and go out in another light skiff to move with the wind and the pod of killer whales on their way through Perry Passage. There are silver flashes of salmon in the air. The whales are feeding as they swim. We take the skiff out to the left side of where the whales should be coming back to the surface. You want to be within 20, 30 feet to take the pictures.
The angle off a little.
Yeah, a little left.
Yeah.
Okay.
They just slowed right up all of a sudden.
Yeah. Well, they look like they stopped to feed or something.
There we go. That's an AB7.
That's who?
AB7.
Okay.
It has a calf. It had a calf either last year or the year before. I think the year before. Angle off a little more left, I think. They're cutting across to the left.
Craig Matkin is the photographer. He's taken pictures of these whales before, and he recognizes on site many of what is called the AB pod, which is a resident group, about 40 whales spending most of the year together in Prince William Sound.
Yeah, AB7 has what you call an open saddle patch. You notice how the white patch, there's a black indentation that goes into it. Speed up and a little to the left.
The photographs, Ilford 400 black and white film, Nikon 8008 autofocus, 300 zoom lens, the photographs of the dorsal fin and the saddle patch on the body behind the fin can be absolute identification.
That's the granny. It's a better angle left again. There we go. And the calf. All right.
Get it?
That's about it. That's a two-year-old calf. It was the year before last that was born.
The killer whales are black and white and small in whale terms. They are truly dolphins, super dolphins they are called. They can be, though, 30 feet long and weigh up to 5 tons. They are fast and smart, navigating by echolocation. And Craig Matkin believes many of the Prince William Sound whales recognize his boat, and they come along to play, moving in and out of the wake, crossing underneath, leaping in the air.
Oh, oops. Beautiful breach by the mother, full breach out of the water. That white pattern on the belly is incredible. A little bit faster, yeah, here we go. Always moving, killer whales are always moving. The only time I've seen where they haven't moved much was when the oil came around the spring and, there's two instances where I've watched them and they don't move, they stay in one spot. One is when they're waiting at a black cod buoy for somebody to come and pull it. And of course, when the fisherman comes to pull the buoy, they eat the fish off the lines. And then this spring, when the oil moved down the passage and it was on both sides of them, I watched them in an area where they just stayed basically in one place for a period of time. But otherwise, killer whales are always on the move.
Craig Matkin has been learning about whales for 20 years now, since he came up to Alaska from California. He makes a living as a fisherman, but he has a master's degree in marine zoology and a deep, pragmatic curiosity about whales. He's put together a research organization, mostly volunteer work, some funding over the years, money to pay for gas and cameras and film. The Exxon oil spill means an opportunity for those who work with whales. The National Marine Mammals Laboratory wants to know how the whales are doing after the spill, which whales are still in Prince William Sound, which ones have come from Mexico and Hawaii for the summer feeding. The laboratory is keeping track of all those extra expenses that Exxon is expected to pay. Much of the baseline information for this summer study was gathered in 1984 and paid for by another company. The SeaWorld Aquariums wanted to take some whales from Prince William Sound. They couldn't do that without a lot of information.
They hired us to go out and do a census. The main reason they hired us is because they knew we had the background and the photo identification and that we could very possibly go out and identify photographically each animal and do a census where you could say absolutely there are this many animals and they're in these age classes and they're in this pod configuration and they could make a judgment on what animals they wanted to take, and they could also justify the take of these animals.
I see. They could say, well, there's 200 here, and we can take two.
Right. That's right.
Did they take any?
No, they didn't take any. The public outcry against it was so great that they had the permit was revoked, basically, in the end. We encountered a lot of flack for doing the work at all. I personally don't favor the use of animals in captivity for entertainment as such, at least not on a permanent basis where the animals are taken in and never released again. Mm-hmm. But I felt that doing the work, if you don't have the baseline information on the animals, you really can't say anything intelligent about it at all. And if you can't say anything intelligent about it, then I feel you're suffering, you know, and not making the best judgments.
The afternoon on the water is over.
We got the the far left little group, the middle group with the four males in one, and, and some females.
And we got a picture of the helicopter harassment.
Yeah, we got that helicopter one right in the same frame with whales.
Yeah. Yeah.
The whale watchers gather on Craig Matkin's boat, the Lucky Star, a 42-foot purse seiner. Matkin fishes during ordinary summers for salmon. He lives in Homer, Alaska, about 7 hours away on the Lucky Star. He comes out about once a month to visit with the researchers he's hired. He has three whale-watching camps far out in Prince William Sound, two people in each camp. He brings along supplies and encouragement. Kelly Balcom has been out with us this afternoon, taking pictures from an inflatable boat. His camp is at Point Knoll. It would be idyllic except for some discarded oil cleanup booms on the rocks, and the evidence recently of a brown bear's attention. Kelly's campsite was chosen because it's near a rubbing beach, still a favorite spot for the killer whales, even though some oil remains on the rocks. Kelly Balcom was watching one day as a killer whale hovered about 100 feet offshore.
He then, at that point, raced in to the beach and then began rubbing, first his left side, heading towards the far end of the beach, and then his right side coming back in along the beach, just rubbing his body along these small stones on the beach.
Completely up on the beach?
Well, you could see from the shoreline, you could see his pectoral fin out of the water, and when he turned, his dorsal fin and his tail. But I would say 85% of his body was just below the surface, but against the rock, so he was in 3 to 6 feet of water at the time.
Why do they do that?
It feels really good. They're very sensory animals, and in this case, the rubbing on the rocks, it's small, smooth stones, and it just must feel really great. Mm.
Across the water of Night Passage, another whale-watching camp on an island, a rocky beach, a white canvas tent, 12 feet by 10, inside a wood stove, bunk beds, bookshelves, a view of glaciers and the Kenai Mountain Range, 7 miles away. Eva Salidas lives and works here, along with her assistant, Matt Hare. They've invited us in for a banana pancake breakfast. Eva Salidas has spent several summers on Prince William Sound. She's a graduate student now, working with killer whale acoustics. She describes an encounter with a single killer whale.
He was really active at the surface, just by himself, sort of like in his own little world, laying over on his back, slapping his flippers, both flippers at the same time, slapping his tail, just kind of lazing around in the water. And he came, as we approached him to take the photograph, he came and he swam directly under our boat real slowly, and you could watch his body. It was huge, bigger than our boat, swam underneath us. And then as he was passing under the boat, we started to hear the sounds coming up through the hull of the boat. And so we dropped the hydrophone, and he just was making beautiful long calls, loud and clear, and it was just a really interesting feeling to the encounter because he was by himself. Usually when you see them together, it makes a lot of sense, you know, they're communicating, but he was just, it was like he was just by himself, just sort of in his own world, you know, just having a good time or whatever, I don't know. But he started heading out into Montague Strait, heading north, and kept calling. He would come up to the surface and be silent. Then he'd go back down, and as he was down under the water for about 8 or 9 minutes, he would be calling continuously, and he kept repeating that cycle. And when he was a mile and a half away, we were still getting the calls loud and clear on the hydrophone, which is really unusual. And then we couldn't follow because the weather was getting rougher. But it was just, we just watched him go and kept listening.
Later this morning, Eva Salidas and Matt Hare will go out in search of humpback whales. They've seen them almost every day. And 2,000 miles away in Seattle at the National Marine Mammal Laboratory, Sally Miserock, a biologist, spends her days looking at pictures of humpback whales. She has a computer and a video disc player which has 8,000 photographs of whales. When a humpback whale dives, goes underwater, the underside of the tail is usually visible. It's a chance for a good picture of the whale's flukes. And the flukes are the identifiable characteristic of the humpback whale as opposed to the dorsal fins of the killer whales. There's no problem then identifying humpback whales that have been in the winter in Hawaii and have come for the summer to be feeding in Prince William Sound.
Yeah, no, they're very distinctive. It's
It's kind of fun. If we want, we could run a match, and you could see that. Why don't you pick one to run a quick match on?
Oh, it's greater than equal to 30. And
we're going to start with pattern 30 because that fluke is most closely. It's either 30, 31, or 32. We can't see the medial line because it's mostly underwater. And he's also looking at the left side, and in the sector 12 on the fluke map, there's a black circle.
Fluke map is just the pattern of the tail.
It's kind of the layout of the tail. It has 14 sectors in it. So
now we're watching photographs go past.
So this guy is close, as you can see, but he's not the spot that's on the photograph on the screen is in a different location than this line. This is actually a Prince William Sound animal that we're looking at now, but it's not the same as this Hawaii one.
Hey, that looks like it.
Not quite. You can see that spot is a little bit too far over to the left than this guy. But you can see that it's really easy to eliminate the ones that don't match. We realize that there's probably whales that will be not very distinctive or the photograph will be bad, but we postulate that we're not going to screw up a match, that there's so much detail on a whale that if you're careful about making a match, you're not going to call two different whales the same whale.
Has he gone to a different group now?
He had said that this was a distinctive mark before, and now he's saying let's look at the ones that aren't even just distinctive. We'll look at plain old marks. Do circle. Look for that one with the circle. Try that one.
I didn't put circle.
Oh, here he is. Okay. Now.
This is it?
Yeah.
We found it.
Yeah, well, see for yourself. See.
Oh, yeah, because this little black mark is really sort of a little half circle.
Mm-hmm.
And then the left side of the tip of the fluke on the left side is black. Tip of the fluke on the right side is black.
And see this detail over here. And you can see it over there, these two little black lines.
Black
here.
Marks there. Well, I'd have to say this is the same whale.
Yeah. And this is actually a fairly plain whale. He's just got a few different characteristics.
In Night Passage, Prince William Sound, Eva Salidis and Matt Hare are searching for humpback whales. They'll stay out for hours, taking sleeping bags and maybe a sandwich and a thermos of tea. It's a small blue and white cabin skiff. Matt is driving. Eva is sitting on the bow with the camera. The water is flat, green, with sheets of white mist. There are mountains around, unseen for days. We spot some whales from a distance. The humpbacks are 40 to 50 feet long, with big white flippers. They roll heavily through the water, the tail flukes descending. Eva takes a few pictures, but I'm hoping for a chance to hear the blowing of the humpback whale, the spouting from the blowholes, the nostrils, really, that have evolved to the back of the whale's head, the whale's breath, pressurized water vapor, carbon dioxide, nitrogen. It is said to have a musky smell. The boat drifts. I'm hoping a whale will come close enough. There's a wind down from Icy Bay, chunks of glaciers in the water. You can hear stories about ghosts on Prince William Sound, of mummies in the sea caves on the islands. And the blowing of the whale, when it comes, is an ancient sound. The plume is 10 feet high and stays in the air. After the Exxon oil spill in March, 12 gray whales were found, stranded and dead, on Kodiak Island out in the Gulf of Alaska. The bodies were necropsied, the results not available yet. Other whales, killers and humpbacks, were seen traveling through the oil at the time. The humpback whales feed by taking in huge amounts of water and plankton and krill. The food is strained through baleen plates in their mouths, and any oil taken in could be disastrous. The killer whales eat at the top of the food chain, fish and seals, and there could be a buildup of hydrocarbons in their bodies. The whale researchers will try to determine if whales have died, have failed to reproduce, or have been displaced, which they count as injury.
The National Marine Mammal Laboratory will not comment on the findings so far, and it could be 2 years before results are known. But it has been said of the whales in general that pollution is taking up where the harpoon gun left off. And here's another thought. Lines from the poet Heathcote Williams from his book Whale Nation. He's talking about the fact that most of the Earth is water. And he writes, "From space, the planet is blue. From space, the Earth is the territory not of humans, but of the whale."
Alaska Today sued Exxon for failing to prevent the oil spill from the Exxon Valdez. The March 24th disaster left nearly 11 million gallons of crude oil in Prince William Sound. Today's suit, which does not specify an amount sought in damages, also charges the Alyeska Pipeline Company for failing to take prompt and adequate measures to clean up the spill. Peter Kenyon of Alaska Public Radio reports.
Alaska dropped its criminal investigation of Exxon in order to devote all its efforts to this civil case. The result is a 42-page complaint that seeks damages from every major oil producer in the state, as well as civil penalties and court orders to require a complete cleanup. The state holds Exxon liable for the actual grounding of the Exxon Valdez by cutting back on tanker crews and allowing a captain with a history of drinking problems to be in charge of the ship. The Alyeska Pipeline Service Company is charged with deceiving the state about its ability to clean up a spill and then failing to deal with it when it happened. And the state also claims that Exxon and six other pipeline companies, including ARCO, British Petroleum, Amerada Hess, Phillips, Mobil, and Unocal, made a deliberate and, in the state's view, reckless decision to save money by reducing manpower, training, and equipment at Alyeska's Valdez oil terminal. State oil spill coordinator Robert Laresh said in a news conference this morning that those cutbacks reduced Alyeska to a corporate shell, unable to deal with a major spill, and therefore all seven owners of the pipeline consortium are liable for this damage.
It's very clear from our NTSB investigation, as well as other people we've talked to since, that Alyeska Pipeline Service Company had no control over its own affairs, but was rather managed and budgeted for on a daily basis by the owner companies.
After more than 4 months of preparation, this suit was filed in Anchorage Superior Court with no advance warning, largely because the state attorney general was concerned about a possible legal maneuver by Exxon. Under an obscure 19th century federal maritime law, a company can seek to limit its liability for a spill to the value of the tanker after the accident. Even if it wasn't successful, that move could have delayed this and other civil suits while the liability question was settled. The lawsuit seeks penalties for every one of the 11 million gallons that was spilled. That could total up to $100 million by itself. On top of that, the state is asking for damages for all costs involved in removing the oil, replacing lost fish and wildlife, and restoring the environment to its natural condition. The suit says that over 1,000 square miles of Alaska land and waters have been hit with severe environmental damage. Other alleged damages include losses to the economy, including fishing, tourism, and recreation. The state is also asking the court to order the defendants to keep coming back to Alaska until the environment is restored. The lawsuit doesn't seek a specific amount of damages, but Laresh says the total could reach the multiple billions of dollars. And he estimates that it could take up to 10 years to resolve this litigation. Lawyers for Exxon could not be reached for an immediate response. For National Public Radio, I'm Peter Kenyon in Juneau, Alaska.